from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Bruce Lee was a cultural icon, martial arts master, and a movie star. He was also a kid born in San Francisco's Chinatown. He spent most of his youth in Hong Kong and Seattle, but when he returned to San Francisco in 1959 at age 18, he set off on a path that would transform martial arts. In the hour coming up of Forum, we talk about Bruce Lee's time in San Francisco before he hit Hollywood, battling with traditional masters of martial arts, both physically and ideologically. He would end up changing martial arts and the cultural image of Asian men. We'll talk about Bruce Lee and the Bay Area martial arts scene. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. It's no coincidence that the Bay Area has such a thriving martial arts scene. Bruce Lee, one of the sport's modern masters, was born in San Francisco's Chinatown and returned to the area as a teen. Lee went on to transform martial arts, combining various styles and bringing freedom and self-expression to the traditional disciplines. Joining us to talk about Bruce Lee's years in the Bay Area and the thriving martial arts scene that continues here are Charles Russo, who is the author of a book, Striking Distance, Bruce Lee and the Dawn of Martial Arts in America. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Gene Ching in here with us in studio. He's associate publisher of Kung Fu Tai Chi magazine, the largest English language magazine and website devoted exclusively to Chinese martial arts. They're based in Fremont. Welcome.
It's an honor to be here.
Good to have you here. And let me also welcome here in studio Gary Kaganan, and he's an instructor in Jeet Kune Do, Bruce Lee's martial arts style. He trained under Bruce Lee's disciple, James Lee, in Oakland, and we welcome you to the program as well. Thank
it's
you for
a pleasure.
Being here.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. Let me begin, if I may, Gene Ching, with you. Charles Russo, let me begin with you. I want to talk about Bruce Lee, who remains an extraordinarily iconic figure. In fact, he's probably as popular now as he ever was, isn't he?
Yeah. Bruce Lee has remained remarkably relevant into the 21st century. And I think what's interesting about Bruce is his legacy is really not one-dimensional. He sort of has this multifaceted appeal with people. He resonates with people in a variety of ways. For instance, one of the things that's very current right now is with the popularity of MMA competitions, mixed martial arts, in which recently even, you know, the UFC sold for $4+ billion. The president of the UFC cites Bruce Lee as the godfather of MMA. So in that regard, you know, he's sort of a cultural visionary.
Can you tell us what UFC is?
UFC is the Ultimate Fighting Championship. It's sort of the main MMA league.
But yet there are also new comic books and there's a Broadway musical in the works, more movies. And when you say he's multidimensional, he was also known for, well, he was a child actor and a screen actor and made movies about him and so forth. I mean, there's martial arts, but that was really his primary interest. That was really what he loved and what he was so devoted to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting, though. You know, Bruce Lee was very much born into show business. His father was a very well-known and very successful actor. And in fact, you know, the reason why Bruce Lee was born in San Francisco is because his parents had come over with the Hong Kong Cantonese Opera. And they were brought here by one of the theaters in Chinatown, the Mandarin Theater, which is right on Grand Avenue. It was later renamed the Sun Sing Theater, as some people would know it. And, you know, those are sort of the unique circumstances for why Bruce Lee was born here. His family was from Hong Kong, and there was really no immigration into America from China at the time. So it was sort of unique circumstances. And in November of 1940, he was born at the Chinese hospital on Jackson Street.
But he also spent those years in Hong Kong where he learned a good deal about street fighting, which contributed to the kind of martial arts we identify him with.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting about him growing up in Hong Kong and learning martial arts there is he's involved in this very sort of robust street fighting culture. And this very much shapes his martial arts worldview. He sees up close sort of what works for real in real situations versus what is sort of just flamboyant nonsense that looks really nice in the studio but doesn't really have any practical application. And he'll advocate for, you know, his kind of sense for the martial arts along these realistic lines, you know, for the remainder of his life.
Well, he certainly changed martial arts. And let's talk with Gene Ching about that. I mean, but before we do, I want to get more of the history here because it's fascinating to realize he came here in 1959, came back at 18 years old, Gene. But in 1964, we had the Year of the Green Dragon. We also had Bruce Lee in this behind closed doors, which has become really a legendary fight, a mano a mano, one-on-one fight. Talk about that.
Well, you're talking about the Wong Jack Man fight,
yeah,
which has gone down in history as the most debated martial arts fight in America. I think there was a symbolic quality to it in that Wong Jack Man, who is still in the area and still has students in the area, he's still alive. He represented this old school traditional lineage of martial arts, and Bruce Lee was this rather cocky upstart. But they were the same age, and they were both dominant martial artists in the San Francisco Bay Area. There's so much debate, and there's been so much debate over the last 50 years on what happened in that fight.
Well, there was also a lot more at stake. You suggested, you know, different views of martial arts, but also Bruce Lee was teaching Caucasians and non-Asians, and that was really not the way that many saw the spreading of martial arts philosophy and martial arts as essentially a way of fighting and so forth.
Well, that is the dominant story. There's some people that contest that it wasn't really about that. But it's hard to say, you know. There was only a few people in the room, only a few witnesses, and many of them passed on at this point. Of course, all the witnesses were very biased because they were with one party or the other.
Let's talk about just the amazing martial arts scene here, which continues. And I'm opening Charles Russo's book here because he says, when it came to the martial arts in America during the early 1960s, and we're talking about when this legendary fight took place, San Francisco Bay Area was the place to be, having benefited from the talent and influence of a diverse array of practitioners who had migrated from southern China, Hong Kong, Japan, and Hawaii. As Al Tracy, a local Kenpo teacher and colleague of Ed Parker at the time, would characterize it, the real significant early development of the martial arts in the United States was heavily based in the Bay Area, and many of those important people came here not just for Chinese but for the martial arts. I mean, it was a thriving, vibrant scene, really, wasn't it?
And it still is.
And still is, yeah.
The Bay Area is one of the major hubs in the United States for all styles of martial arts. One of the major contenders to UFC was Strikeforce, and that came up right here in San Jose.
And I mentioned before when I studied under legendary master Yamaguchi, and that was the Japanese style. I mean, it was just suddenly open. And talk also about the changing nature for Asians with Bruce Lee. I mean, he was of mixed race, but nevertheless, he changed the whole attitude toward. I mean, suddenly he had this 5'8", extremely powerful, unbelievably fast with his fists and so forth, guy who's up on screen, who's an icon. And it really altered the whole vision of Asian men in many ways, didn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, he's still amazingly charismatic. He just electrifies the scene whenever you see any of his movies. You know, Jackie Chan just got his honorary Oscar. And he's been in over 200 films. Bruce Lee, while he had a couple obscure films, there were really only 4 martial arts films that he was featured in as the lead. And each of those films, every moment that he's on screen, he is totally captivating. You can't discount the fact that he was amazingly charismatic.
He was amazingly charismatic. He was also described once as a dissident with bad manners. Where did that come from again, Charles?
Yeah, that's easily my favorite quote in the entire book. It comes from one of the old kung fu teachers in Chinatown, T.Y. Wong. And I think it's very telling, one, because, you know, as far as the bad manners go, Bruce's personality could be a bit polarizing. Some people saw him as very charismatic and energetic and fun to be around, while others saw him to be very brash and egotistical. But the dissident part of that, I think, is really interesting in that, you know, especially when Bruce is in the Bay Area, increasingly he begins to air his martial arts worldview, which is very critical to some of the existing practices. And, you know, here you have this small, young, out-of-town kid who is disputing what all the established masters are teaching in their schools. And there's sort of a laundry list of rising tensions that Bruce Lee begins to have with San Francisco.
It was revolutionary, really, wasn't it?
Sure.
And in fact, I want to talk about that style because it's often associated with Jeet Kune Do, which is where Gary Ganahan brings his expertise into that. What is the distinctness of that revolutionary style? How would you define it?
Well, I would characterize Jeet Kune Do as a style or a system which Bruce actually never wanted to pigeonhole into a style or system. It was more of a freedom of expression through martial arts. The turning point in Bruce's development or evolution as a martial artist came as a result of the altercation with Wong Jack Man, at which time Bruce felt that what he had learned and what he had practiced prior to that was inefficient, and he felt that he could have done much better. And that's what gave birth to his newfound birth as a martial artist. He changed the way he trained. He looked at things differently in terms of how he applied himself physically. And he pretty much disdained a lot of the classical methods of traditional Chinese martial arts.
And as I mentioned earlier, you actually trained under Bruce Lee's disciple, James Lee.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And by that time, this had become pretty much a part of the world of martial arts. I mean, this particular style. Yeah,
at that period in time, it was really starting to blow up. Bruce had three primary disciples, James Lee in Oakland, Denny Inosanto in Los Angeles, and Taki Kimura in Seattle. And
Bruce was in Seattle before he came here, right?
Bruce was in Seattle initially, then he came to Oakland, and then went to Los Angeles.
Was there a spiritual element to, or is there a spiritual element to this? I mean, when I studied karate, it had all those earmarks.
What was taught at Jimmy's school through Bruce kind of did away with all that stuff, you know, the traditionalism and whatnot.
I mean, bowing and all, yeah.
Yeah, well, we had the traditional bowing and whatnot at the beginning of the class, but we didn't have uniforms or anything like that. It was like a blue-collar type martial arts situation. Guys came in wearing combat boots and jeans and whatnot, whatever was comfortable. And it was quite different from traditional martial arts training and tradition. It was very non-traditional.
Gary Gaganan, again, is an instructor in Jeet Kune Do, and that's Bruce Lee's martial arts style. He could have opened a whole bunch of schools, right? I mean, he only had a couple going, really, but he was such a famous name that he could have had hundreds going nationwide if he wanted to.
He could have easily opened up a plethora of schools across the country, and I believe he had offers to do so. But Bruce was very concerned about quality control with respect to what was being taught. And that was the reason why he never ventured into opening commercial schools.
And he continues, as we've said, to be this major icon, Gene Ching. There's also something about Bruce Lee that many people don't know. He had a lot of family that survived him, but they're not necessarily cashing in, are they?
Not necessarily cashing in. Well,
on his name, on the products, on the branding, and all the rest of it?
Well, his daughter is taking control. His daughter Shannon is taking control of the estate. And rightly so, I think. When you think about Bruce Lee, he is the most imitated celebrity of all. I mean, you could say Elvis Presley, a lot of Elvis Presley impersonators. But there are tons of actors in Asia that made their entire career impersonating Bruce Lee. I remember talking to Linda Lee Caldwell, or his widow, about all the different Bruce Lee movies that weren't Bruce Lee, and she just shook her head and like, yeah, that's not him. I have to explain to so many people that's not him. He only made those four movies.
I thought a lot of the residuals weren't necessarily going to the family.
Well, they aren't.
Yeah.
And the family is trying to control that because for one thing, it's Asia, it's China, and their sense of intellectual property rights is not always as rigorous, and especially in terms of Bruce Lee, that's become such a cultural icon.
That's said very temperately, if I may say so.
Thank you.
Let me go back to you, Charles Russo. Charles Russo wrote this book, Bruce Lee and the Dawn of Martial Arts in America. We talked about his film career and talked about the fact that he was a teacher of martial arts, very devoted to martial arts. What many listeners who have been following Bruce Lee through the years may not know is he was a cha-cha dancer and an instructor in cha-cha dancing.
Yeah, before Bruce Lee left Hong Kong at the age of 18 to return to San Francisco, he won the national cha-cha dance competition in Hong Kong. And what's interesting is that, you know, when he comes over in 1959, the person he's staying with, his godfather, gets him a job as a busboy at a local restaurant. And this only lasts for about a week. Bruce wasn't very well disposed for that. But he winds up making a living here and earning money for school by giving dance lessons around the Bay Area. He charges a dollar a couple and teaches at events in Chinatown and then over in Oakland. And what he would do is he would sort of grab a down moment, maybe intermission or something, and then he would get up and give a kung fu demonstration and sort of dazzle the audience. What's interesting is increasingly moving into the 60s, Bruce's demonstrations get more and more pointed, where they start to become more and more of sort of a critical lecture where he's airing his worldview, and it starts to raise some eyebrows, particularly within the Bay Area.
Well, let me go back, Gary Gaganin, to the specific nature of his form of martial arts, because the holds, the kicks, it's not only, you know, the movement with the hands, which he was so well known for, but he incorporated so much. He incorporated, you know, things like not only boxing, but fencing, too. You know?
Yes, absolutely. That's where he got a lot of his footwork from, from fencing and Western boxing. Bruce preached fluidity, spontaneity in his martial arts versus set forms and set techniques. He espoused a very natural form of combat, and that was something that worked well for him and eventually developed into his style of Jeet Kune Do.
I'm going to bring our listeners into this discussion. In fact, I know there are many of you who have been involved in the martial arts one way or another, many fans of Bruce Lee who appreciate not only Bruce Lee on the silver screen, but Bruce Lee as an iconic figure in the world of martial arts. And we welcome your phone calls and your emails. In fact, you can join the conversation and bring in perhaps your own experiences or let us know what's on your mind when you think of this thriving and vibrant world of martial arts here in the Bay Area or the legacy of Bruce Lee. Our toll-free number is available right now, and that number is 866-733-6786. You can join us again toll-free at 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but we do invite your involvement in the program. If you have something you'd like to say or ask about Bruce Lee, or something you'd like to add to the conversation, or comment about just the vibrant, I keep calling it vibrant because it is and it remains so, but the martial arts scene and the history of martial arts here in the Bay Area, which has been, you know, pretty extraordinary. Go to a comment here from a listener named Keith who says, I think it's worth mentioning Bruce Lee's role in the 1960s TV series The Green Hornet. For many in middle America, it was their first exposure to martial arts, and he was very popular at a time when there were not many Asian actors on primetime TV. And that indeed, of course, Charles Russo is the case.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's important to point out that prior to Bruce showing up on The Green Hornet, no one really knew what kung fu was, or in many ways, many of the Asian fighting styles. It was a very sort of, still in obscurity within the United States. And Bruce Lee really captures everyone's imaginations through The Green Hornet. And, I've had many people tell me that, the show wasn't that great, but they tuned in just to watch Bruce.
Wasn't he being considered for another role before he got that
Yeah,
role?
So he was – it's interesting. You know, he was actually living in Oakland when he got noticed by Hollywood. And he traveled down to Hollywood in February of 1965 to do screen tests with 20th Century Fox. And it was for a role on Charlie Chan's Number One Son. And that eventually led to him instead getting the role as Cato on the Green Hornet.
And of course, most of the Charlie Chan characters were Caucasian actors disguising themselves as being Asian. I go back to you for a moment, if I may, Gene Ching. And Gene Ching is publisher, associate publisher of Kung Fu Tai Chi magazine, which is the largest English language magazine and website devoted exclusively to Chinese martial arts, located here in Fremont. As I said, I learned Goju Ryu, which is a Japanese form of karate, when I studied it many years ago. How does Chinese – I mean, when you talk about Chinese martial arts, you're talking about many strains of it, many varieties of it. And everything. How does it differ, let's say, from Japanese or from other Asian forms of martial arts? What makes it distinctive?
One of the key things about Chinese martial arts is it's more from a folk practice and monastic practice. When you look at a lot of the Japanese and Korean martial arts, they come from a military tradition, which is why they have ranks and belts, and why they don't wear shoes, because military could afford nice places to train where you didn't have to wear shoes. The Chinese martial arts were much more the people's martial arts, and so you wore shoes, and you didn't necessarily say, look at people that have rank, but it's more familial. So, for example, what we call a master, a shifu, really means father, and you would treat your classmates as elder brothers, younger sisters, uncles, aunts. It's a much more clan-based orientation. And that gives it a slightly different tone than some of the more some of the schools that descend from a more militaristic origin.
And Gary Kaganin, anybody still breaking bricks with their hands and doing those sorts of things?
Oh, sure. That's never going to go away. That's a continued practice.
What else, though, has been invigorated because of Lee? I mean, we've talked about his legacy in general and how he changed the whole nature of martial arts. What else would you cite?
With respect to martial arts, Bruce truly revolutionized martial arts. He, you know, with his role in the Green Hornet, he opened a lot of eyes. But then when he appeared on the big screen, he really became an iconic figure, and everybody wanted to be like Bruce Lee. And that's what changed the whole spectrum of martial arts here in America and all over the world.
It's not only that he was good for, you know, as a model for young Asian kids and all that, as we're Asian in general, but he was only 5'8". You know, a lot of these real martial arts masters are considerably taller than that. So in a sense, you know, his stature sort of was invigorating, I think, and inspiring maybe to people who weren't that tall, weren't over 6 feet, let's say.
Yeah, the common analogy is that dynamite comes in small packages.
Yeah, well, that says it all. Here's Carlo, who writes, "Love me some Bruce Lee. Growing up in San Francisco, my brother took me to see all his movies at the theater of Arguello and Geary. And we'll take more of your comments as well as your questions and calls when we return. We are coming up in a break. I want to remind you that we're talking about Bruce Lee, one of the masters, modern masters of really not only martial arts, but the sports world. He was born in San Francisco's Chinatown and returned as a teen, and not long after came back and transformed martial arts, combining a number of different styles and bringing freedom and self-expression to the traditional disciplines. Also remembered not only, as we've been citing, for the Green Hornet and many other things as well, and has become and remained a very popular figure in martial arts here in the Bay Area, has remained also very popular. Talking with Gene Ching of Kung Fu Tai Chi magazine and Gary Kaganin, who is with Jeet Kune Do, an instructor in that Bruce Lee martial arts style, and Charles Russo, author of Striking Distance, Bruce Lee and the Dawn of Martial Arts in America. When we return, we'll hear from you. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about Bruce Lee and San Francisco's pioneering martial arts scene. I was just saying off air that there have been attempts through the years to bring some kind of museum to the Bay Area, memorializing Bruce Lee. Ron Dellums, when he was mayor of Oakland, talked a good deal about things along those lines. We might want to hear from some of our listeners about what they think would be appropriate. But let's hear from those of you who have joined the queue here to talk. Let me begin, Tina, with you. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say that Bruce Lee was more than martial arts to me. I'm from the Bay Area, and I just feel like he's something for all of us to be proud of. And I just wanted to get that out there. You know, he was so much bigger than just martial arts or TV. He had a lot of philosophies and gave a lot of interviews that kind of enlightened us all a little bit. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. We thank you for the call, Tina. We go right to another caller, and that's Richard, who's joining us from New York. Richard. Oh, I'm sorry. No, we go first to Loner, who's joining us from San Francisco. Loner, you're on.
Yes, thank you. You know, you never really realize just some of the influences in your life until you hear a show like this. Even though I grew up in rural Alaska, running around the woods and alpine skiing and all that, as a kid of the 60s, watching the Green Hornet faithfully, I'm quite confident that it was Bruce Lee who really had a big influence on me in becoming a professional dancer and developing a life philosophy of mastery. And here I am 25 years into full-time Asian art, healing arts, and living in San Francisco. So it's interesting how things come full circle in our lives. But I know Bruce Lee, right now I can really recognize how he had just a huge influence on my worldview starting as a young man.
Well, thank you for that call, and a huge influence on so many people, really. And I know we're going to hear from more people about the influence that he had. Getting some comments about that Wong Jack Man fight, though. Here's Clint, who wants to know, what are your guest comments on Rick Wing's book, Showdown in Oakland, the story behind the Wong Jack Man Bruce Lee fight? And Bob writes, so what happened at the Wong Jack Man fight? Who won? This is all up for grabs, really. I mean, in fact, there's still somebody said it was 3 minutes. Somebody said it was 25 minutes. Somebody else said it was a draw. We really just don't know, do we? Charles, you want to weigh in here? Charles Russo?
The calls that you're getting, it goes to show what a absolutely contentious topic it is.
Still,
50 years after it went down, there are still people arguing about it. You know, what I try to do in the book was there were seven people in the room witnessing the fight. And what I try to do was go off of the firsthand accounts of people that were there and witnessed it. And, you know, I describe down to an individual who they were and why they were there. But it's a touchy topic.
Wong Jack Man wouldn't make himself available to talk to you, or
he doesn't speak on the topic. Yeah. With the exception of an interview that he did with a Chinatown newspaper in the aftermath of the fight, he has remained silent on the topic for half a century.
So, what, any guesses, Gene or Gary?
Well, one thing that's for sure is that A, there was a fight, an altercation that took place. B, that Bruce won it. How long it took Bruce to win it, how Bruce won it, is a matter of conjecture as far as an historical perspective is concerned.
You're speaking with certainty about his winning, but some say it was a draw, right?
Well, I've never heard that it was a draw. But the story that I get came directly from James Lee, and James said Bruce won the fight. It's as simple as that. History has a way of changing over the course of time, and that's why a lot of the confusion and ambiguity has arisen with respect to how that fight took place. But bottom line is, there was a fight and Bruce won it.
Well, Gene Ching, you were kind of maybe downplaying the idea that there was that part of that fight was the ideological battle over whether or not Asians should be non-Asians should be instructed by masters. Here's a listener who writes, this is Melvin. In the 1970s, I wrote for Black Belt Magazine and Karate Illustrated. I interviewed a Wushu master named Alan Lee, who had a kun in New Jersey. He confirmed that, like Bruce Lee, when he started teaching Westerners Wushu, he too received death threats from masters in the local Chinese community. It was a rather eye-opening discussion, and I became much more attuned to discrimination in that way.
That did occur with several masters and several cover stories that I've worked on. That topic has come up during that period. It was... Well, like I said earlier, martial arts, the Chinese martial arts are very clan-based. So you've got to think of China as more of a tribal society in that respect. They had all these different clans, and your style was also your village, which was also your surname. And so there was a lot of secrecy, and there was a lot of possessiveness. It wouldn't only be limited necessarily to non-Chinese, but you might not teach certain things to anybody outside your clan. These techniques were considered very secretive and very the root of their power and their skills. So it may have been a factor. I mean, the Wong Jack Man fight has been argued for so long. In our online forum, there's a discussion thread that's been going for some 40 some odd pages, almost 50 pages now. Our forum has been online since 2002. it's still a debated topic, and I think it will never really be resolved.
Gary Kagan, looking at a comment from a listener here, let me get a response from you. Fabiola writes, mixed martial arts has seen an evolution in terms of what martial arts styles dominate in the ring. How does that combination of styles compare to Jeet Kune Do? I'm curious if Jeet Kune Do predicted the evolution of MMA before its time, maybe.
Well, the way Bruce developed and formulated Jeet Kune Do came as a result of his belief that there was no one true system in martial arts, that there were techniques that he could derive from many different systems and combine them, use what is useful, eliminate what's not useful, and develop a training method that is effective for the individual. And that's what he really pushed, was individuality. Because you can't, in his philosophy, cookie-cutter martial artists. Everybody has a different set of skills, different mindset. And so that's what he preached. And
there's a lot of fighting to win, though, isn't it? Really?
Well, that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Bruce always felt that, as far as Jeet Kune Do was concerned, and his philosophy is what you learn today, you can use today. And it was not something that you had to train for months and years in terms of techniques to become effective. What you learned today, you could use out on the street the
very
same day.
That's very pragmatic, really. Let me bring some more callers into this discussion. This is Richard from New York. Richard, welcome.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hello, Gary and Jeff. Me, Richard Torres from Jeet Kune Do.
Hi. Hi, Richard.
How's it going?
Good.
Another thing to note, as far as the Walk Young Man fight is concerned, Bruce Lee always referred to Walk Young Man as the runner after that fight. It had to be a good reason that he called him the runner after that. Was the nickname that Bruce Lee gave Walk Young Man. But I wanted to ask a question in regards to Bruce Lee teaching Cha-Cha. I know he taught Cha-Cha to James Lee's brother, who was the one who introduced Bruce to James Lee. But I wanted to know if that was done in San Francisco or in Oakland as far as those Cha-Cha lessons was concerned.
Gary, I assume that was Oakland, yeah?
I would assume it was Oakland.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Richard. Let me bring a few more comments. Tyler writes, I practiced Jeet Kune Do in a garage 20 years ago in San Jose, and it was life-changing. My question is, given its local origin, why are there so few venues to study Jeet Kune Do in the Bay Area? Gary?
Again, it was a quality control issue. It's a lineage issue. A lot of people claim to be JKD instructors, or they claim to have learned from Bruce or any of his three disciples, Jimmy, Danny, Taki. It's hard to discern. And so anybody that comes up with a Jeet Kune Do school, it's going to be highly scrutinized. So you really can't counterfeit something like that because of the lineage. Everybody knows who's who.
And here is Mike joining us from San Jose. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd just like to make a comment about the Wong Jack Man versus Bruce Lee fight. Not necessarily about the winner or loser, but just the motivation for the contest. I'm Caucasian. My instructor was Caucasian and was taught by Wong Jack Man. He started training with Wong Jack Man in the early 1970s. So the racist overtones here, meaning that the Chinese did not want to necessarily teach Caucasians, and that was the motivation for the fight, is really a false narrative. Again, it was a long time ago. I don't know if anybody really knows for sure.
Unless Long Jack Man's changed his view of getting, you know, post that fight. That was in the 60s, remember. You're talking about
the
70s.
It was the late 1960s. It would be strange for someone to change their opinion within, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. Maybe it could have happened. I'm not saying it didn't, but from what I know of Wong Jack Man, I've met him myself, it doesn't seem like something that would fit with his character.
Well, thank you for weighing in. I appreciate that. And actually, Gary Russo had a response. Charles Russo, excuse me. Charles?
Yeah, I appreciate that call, and I agree with the caller, actually. What I found in my research, and it comes into a lot of nuance. I do think there was a code for a very long time which excluded non-Chinese students. That said, by the early 1960s, and this is something that I go into great detail in the book about, there are numerous examples of that code sort of winding down. In fact, in early 1960, Al Novak, someone who taught for a very long time in the East Bay, he was training in Chinatown, a Caucasian student training in Chinatown with T.Y. Wong. So while there has been this sort of narrative for a long time, I think when you look at the nuance of it, I really think that the fight was based more on Bruce's at times brash personality. And again, going back to that long list of ongoing tensions with Chinatown and the contentious demonstrations that Bruce Lee was giving, I think it had a lot more to do with that. And I think Wong Jackman's been kind of unfairly characterized in the long run in light of, you know, what a big star Bruce Lee had become over the years.
Well, he was a pretty brash guy, you know, and you can see where a more traditional, I would find him offensive even.
Absolutely. You know, it's important to point out that, and not a lot of people make this link, but Bruce had a fight in Seattle a few years earlier to the Wong Jackman fight, which was really predicated on the same circumstances. Bruce was giving a demonstration. He made certain distinctions between kung fu and karate, and he insulted a local karate practitioner who challenged him to a fight. So there was precedent for this. And to me, and you know, as far as the research I've done, I think it had a lot more to do with that.
And we'll have some more calls. Let me go next to Clayton. Clayton, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, I'm here. I lived in China many years. I'm fluent in Mandarin and Beijing. Before that, studying years of Japanese style is very intense. And then living in China for a decade, back and forth, traveling and living there. My teacher there, since deceased, I'm an instructor. I just want to comment, one, the distinction, huge difference between what went on in Hong Kong and China, in mainland China. And then the second thing, my teacher has been, who I said is deceased, we were very into fighting in the sense of that Bruce Lee, whose Chinese name is Li Xiaolong, was looked at as someone who could fight and not someone who just was in movies. And this is people who lived in Cultural Revolution, who lived in a very through that and had a long time living throughout China and developed ideologies that way and extinct ones about martial arts, whereas Jet Li from Beijing was not viewed the same way as Bruce Lee, nor was Jackie Chan. They were viewed much more as movie stars, kind of action stars, where Bruce Lee really put metal to the metal, and that's what he's really known for in kind of a deeper sense.
Yeah, so, I think that's a true observation, and I thank you for that. In fact, I'm going to read a comment from Ben, which dovetails. He says, the fact that Bruce Lee died over 40 years ago and there hasn't been another Asian-American actor who's reached his level of fame is sad. Statement on the whitewashing of Hollywood. Thankfully, Asia has grown their own show business people, and we have greats like you mentioned, Jet Li, Donnie Yen, and others finally making it into American cinema. Here's a comment I'd like to go to you on, Gene Ching. This is Lucas who writes, can you please comment on the prevalence of what we in the martial arts community dub McDojos or commercialized studios and their effect on the Bay Area martial arts scene?
McDojos. Well, you got to keep in mind that Bruce Lee was in a period before the idea of a martial arts franchise. Well, when it was just starting, one of his contemporaries, Ed Parker, would build one of the greatest martial arts franchises in the United States. And now there are a considerable amount of what we call strip mall schools, especially in the Bay Area. It's hard to find a strip mall in the Bay Area that doesn't have some kind of martial arts school. I think the hard part about that is that the way martial arts were trained traditionally, it was much more of a live-in culture. You would disciple under a master and endure all these arduous training techniques. Nowadays, most schools make their money as glorified daycare centers, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's the martial arts have a moral code that they try to preach and propound. And certainly the idea of fitness is very important. And those are great things to imbue to our youth. But I think a lot of sort of old school martial artists get this traditional sense that, well, they're not really learning how to fight. They're not really learning, you know, to take care of themselves. It's a topic of considerable debate nowadays.
It's the same thing people debate about yoga. You know?
I mean, absolutely.
And let me bring on more of our callers. Let me get to Lynn next. Lynn, you're on.
Hello. I have a very interesting book. The title is King Dragon, The World of Bruce Lee. And it's by a friend of mine's uncle, Norman Borine, B-O-R-I-N-E. And it's many wonderful pictures of Bruce Lee. The inside first leaf says, in celebration, the life and legacy of Bruce Lee on the 35th anniversary of his death. And this man that wrote it, Norman Borine, knew him in Hollywood. Norman Borine was what I call a chorus boy. He was a dancer in the movies in Hollywood in the 40s. And he made the acquaintance, I guess. I'm not really knowledgeable on this these details, but he was Norman was the dancer, and he had these contracts and got to know through contracts that the movie industry was making with Bruce Lee. Bruce was, I don't know if he ever was really under contract with Paramount or Warner Brothers, but they did want him for some things, like television also. But anyway, the book, King Dragon, A Chronicle of the Life and Works of Bruce Lee by Norman Borine, who was also the founder of the World of Bruce Lee Museum in Hollywood.
Well, Lynn, thanks for bringing that to our attention. In fact, it gives us a leg up on our program we're going to do tomorrow in this 10 o'clock hour, where we just get listener recommendations on books, the sort of thing we do a few times a year. And thank you for that call. And let me bring on another caller. This is Bernie from Berkeley. Bernie, you're on.
Yes, thank you for having me on. I'm born and raised in San Francisco. I actually saw my first Bruce Lee movie in the 70s, Fist of Fury, on the Mission. And I've been involved in martial arts for like 40-plus years. I have to agree with your speaker regarding the cookie-cutter school. What I find disturbing is a lot of instructors out there trying to teach Bruce Lee style always state in their profiles or their website that they trained under him or they were close associated with him. So my question is, how do you deal with posers or posies? And then secondly is, a lot of people are not giving credit regarding how meticulous Bruce Lee was with his training regarding recording how many punches, how many kicks, plus how he was into circuit training and weightlifting and nutrition that people don't really realize about him and his background.
Yeah, both good questions. Yeah. Thank you for those, Bernie. Let me go to Gary again and again. I mean, posers, they're out there, right?
They certainly are. And I think the easiest way to discern posers from legitimate practitioners is to check their lineage and take
it from
there.
Best way to do that?
The best way to do that is to ask questions. And determine where they learned from, who their instructor was, who the instructor's instructor was, and you can determine pretty much whether or not they're legitimate.
Well, you also talked about Bruce Lee's meticulousness. You want to address that?
Meticulousness in the sense of?
Well, recording a number of hits and kicks and everything else.
Yes, he was a voluminous note taker. He was very keen on documenting his training methods, how he trained, when he trained, what he did, things of that nature.
I'm getting a lot of requests for good martial arts schools in the Bay Area, where they, in fact, this one listener, Wes, writes, where they focus on the art of martial arts but are not all about beating each other up. I've had a hard time finding schools that are not about aggression because of the rise of ultimate fighting. Gene, can you help us here? Gene Ching?
Well, I can't officially give recommendations for schools. Besides, that would take up the whole rest of the program because there are so many schools in the Bay Area. People tend to fall on
either. Well, what do you
side.
Look for? Maybe let's get into that. What should the touchstones or the criteria be?
Resonance, because every style is unique. And so you want to find a style that fits with you. I mean, not everybody's going to be an MMA fighter. Not everybody's going to be into Jeet Kune Do. Some people really like that classical training. I think one of the things that people often overlook with Bruce Lee is that he was highly literate and he comes from a classical background. So some people will make that jump that, oh, you know, Jeet Kune Do is this great answer. But it comes from a very well-researched tradition. And Lee was, as Gary said, an incredible note-taker and incredibly well-read on the subject of martial arts, of philosophy. A lot of things that are attributed to him were ideas that he poached in a way. But he translated – he was kind of the right person at the right time, that he brought a lot of these ideas out. A lot of his most famous quotes and movies are – you can find the roots of those in Buddhism and Taoism and Confucianism. He was very well read.
He also read a lot of Lao Tzu, I remember.
Indeed.
Charles Russo, here's Matt. He almost could have expected this question would come up. He writes, growing up in San Francisco, we all watched Bruce Lee movies and then ran around play fighting and imitating the sound of a karate chop. We were very into the martial arts movement. But when Bruce Lee died, the rumors were rampant about him being murdered. Is there any conclusive theory about how he died?
Oh, geez. You know, my book really chronicles his time, sort of a few chapters of his early life, and really tries to flesh out his time in the Bay Area. So that's not a topic that I really looked into. But I will say this. I mean, as far as my personal opinion, I kind of think Bruce Lee maybe kind of pushed it a little too far and worked himself to death in the sense that he was so 24/7 just going nonstop that I think that, you know, rather than some conspiracy theory about the death touch or something like that.
But there's bound to be with somebody that young. I mean, he was
sure, absolutely. I think at some point maybe his, his body buckled a little bit under the constant activity.
Well, we're going to go to more calls here while we have some time, and let's get Barbara on next. Barbara, you're on.
Yes, I have two questions. And there's a teenage girl in my family who's involved in MMA, and I want to know if you have any ideas about what a good age is for teenagers, or if there is any good age for teenagers to start that. And also, does mixed martial arts mean that many different arts can compete, or is there something that's exactly called mixed martial arts?
Oh, Gary, let me
my
go.
My level.
Thanks for those questions, Barbara. Let me go to you, Gary, first. It's a controversial question about how young a teenager ought to be still in terms of approaching the martial arts, learning the martial arts.
That can be a difficult question because it really depends on the individual, what they want out of martial arts training. There's a cultural component, there's a combative component, there's an artistic component. And when you're talking about kids and the proper age, it really depends on the individual and what they want out of it.
You got to worry about injuries, though. I mean, Gene Ching, let's have you weigh in here, please.
Well, first thing you got to understand is that MMA, as it stands today, is a sport. It is when we think about Bruce Lee and Jeet Kune Do, that is a method of fighting, a street fighting. So take Bruce Lee's most iconic weapon, the nunchuck. You don't see that in MMA. And you'll never see that in MMA because MMA is a sport. It is defined in a very specific thing. It originally was called NHB, No Holds Barred, and it was this sort of confluence of different martial arts styles fighting against each other. But pretty quickly, because of the nature of the ring, of the octagon, and the padded floor, it changed to become its own independent thing. In terms of being a teenager, it is a full MMA is full contact. So with any full contact sport, whether it be boxing or football, you do have to have concerns about hand injury, certainly. And that's been coming to the forefront lately with MMA and sports in general.
And let me thank you, Barbara, for the call and go right to another caller. And that's Terrence. You're on.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I was a student of Wong Jack Man's back from about 2002 to 2004. I just wanted to mention you know, in reference to the false narrative that, you know, the fight was over Bruce's right to teach non-Chinese. In the class I was in, you know, it was very multicultural. I mean, we had people from Italy, we had an African-American, there was myself, and I'm Caucasian. And so, yeah, I just wanted to maybe point that out. And then it's also worth noting about the fight, you know, that Wong Jack Man was considered the runner. I mean, that could very well be because Bruce couldn't land any punches on him. And, you know, and also he quit Wing Chun after 10 years. I mean, he studied that style in depth for 10 years. And, I mean, I really haven't known anyone to quit their style after winning a fight. But, you know, it also points to how influential that was in his forming of Jeet Kune Do. So yeah, I just thought
No, I'm glad you put in there, and I thank you for that call. We're coming up to the end, last of this program. Something I mentioned earlier, and that is, how would you gentlemen here, who obviously have spoken very glowingly and with tribute to Bruce Lee, how would you like him remembered specifically? There's been talk, like I said, about museums, maybe a broader martial arts museum or some kind of testament to Bruce Lee. Any wish list here?
I would love to see something in the Bay Area. I kind of came to this topic because, you know, as someone really interested in Bay Area history, I was really amazed the first time I learned that Bruce Lee was born here. It was kind of puzzling to me that someone as famous as that isn't celebrated as a local son. So I would like to see something, and I don't know what that would be exactly, but he certainly deserves it.
Yeah. From Gene or Gary as we wind up here?
Oh, absolutely. He is one of San Francisco's most global stars. I love that the Giants do a Bruce Lee night. That
so
sort
should
of thing.
Be something, in other words, something big. Something. Yeah?
Absolutely. Bruce really needs to be recognized as far as his roots here in the Bay Area is concerned, particularly Oakland. And I'd really like to see that.
Well, thank you all, and a pleasure to be with all of you, Gene Ching, Charles Russo, and Gary Gannon. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue the discussion online by going to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.